Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The first U.S. Census in 1790 counted fewer than 4 million people in a newborn country. When the 2010 forms arrive in mailboxes next week, the projected U.S. population will top 310 million. That's a lot of people to count, a lot of forms to send in, a lot of census workers out knocking on doors. For cash-strapped states, billions of dollars are at stake, not to mention seats in Congress, raw political clout. This hour on Point, the 2010 census, money, power, and what the numbers will tell us about the emerging face of America. You can join the conversation. Are you ready to mail in and be counted? Are you ready to learn all over again who we are by the numbers? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The Census Bureau is spending millions on a multimedia campaign, outreach campaign, including TV spots to maximize participation.
I'm just one guy, but when I fill out the census, I'm helping to build a better school for Pete and Jen, and improving our roads for Mr. Griffo's carpool.
Roads, schools, power, and more. We begin with a look at the 2010 census itself. Carol Morello is on the census beat for the Washington Post. Carol, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's good to be here.
So tell us about the form that's going to arrive in all those mailboxes next week. What's it look like? What's the government asking?
Well, it's a pretty straightforward questionnaire. It's blue and white. It's 6 pages, but that's only if you have a lot of people in your family, up to 12 people. There's room to write information about each one of them. It's basically 10 questions per person, although one of the questions is, what's your phone number so we can call you in case there's something we don't understand? So there's really only 9 questions. They're basically asking, how many people are living in your house? Are you an owner or a renter? What's your name, your gender, your age, and your race and ethnicity? And do you sometimes live someplace else? That's it. They say their slogan is 10 questions, 10 minutes, but if you're just filling it out for yourself, you can probably do it in less than 2 minutes.
When you look at this form, how do you think Americans are going to respond? How have they in the past? Do they have a good response rate from this form? Do people just say, sure, fine, here's my name, here's my wife's name, my children, my cousin, whoever's in my household, here's our race, everything else, and it's in the, postage prepaid envelope and back to you, fine. How many people, what portion just do that?
Well, roughly, one of the problems is, in fact, the percentages have been declining over the last few censuses. I believe, actually, they went up marginally in the 2000 census, and it reversed a decline somewhat. But generally speaking, 2 out of 3 people respond. 1 out of 3 do not. And that's one of the reasons why they're spending so much money advertising and forming partnerships with groups. They're trying to get the census response rate up.
They're saying that for every 1% increase in households that respond by mail, taxpayers save about $85 million. That's because if you don't respond by mail, you're going to have a census counter, census taker, knocking personally on your door.
Not only knocking personally on your door, but they could be coming back as much as 6 times until they get someone who answers. And if you still don't answer, that doesn't mean you're necessarily not going to be counted. They're going to knock on the doors of your neighbors to try and find out how many people live there, man, woman, children. It will not be as full a count as if you did it yourself, but they're trying, because there is no statistical sampling in which they can adjust the figures on what they presume is happening. They're trying to get as complete a count as they can.
Is there a legal consequence for not responding to the census?
Not that I'm aware of. No, there's not. I think the main consequence is that the argument that your community, your neighborhood, will not get its fair share of dollars, and there may not be a quite fair representation in Congress.
What about legal guarantees of protection of privacy? I see a release here from the Census Bureau saying that there's strict protection, strict confidentiality of everything that goes on these forms. Is that clear?
Well, it says right up at the top. The first line is, this is the official form. It's quick and easy, and your answers are protected by law. Everywhere Bob Groves, the census director, goes, he talks about the consequences of confidentiality being broken. He himself would be responsible. It's a $250,000 fine and up to 5 years in prison. And one of the reasons he keeps stressing that is because there are concerns that in some so-called hard-to-count communities, you know, a sense that perhaps the information will not be kept privacy might keep the response rate down. So it's a point that he's trying to emphasize everywhere he goes.
The Justice Department saying last week, your paper's reporting, that even the Patriot Act will not override federal confidentiality laws around the U.S. Census.
That's right. That has been a particular concern of Arab and Muslim communities ever since this is the first census since 9/11, and there's a concern that Homeland Security might try to get some information from the census other than what is just available to everyone, and that it could work to their detriment. That's at least the excuse that some people give, although the leaders of the communities are saying, no, that's not the case. You should participate. This is to our advantage.
It's also a first for the advance letter that went out this week, for them to send out a bilingual advance letter to about 13 million households in areas where Spanish is predominantly spoken at home. First for that, too.
And the census, those same 13 million households are going to be getting a bilingual census as well for the first time. That's correct. They've targeted neighborhoods where there is a heavy Spanish-speaking presence, a high number of Spanish speakers, and they sent out actually a total of 120 million advance letters.
Mm-hmm.
And certain numbers are in Spanish. I spent some time part of the day yesterday with Bob Groves. He told me in the next census in 2020, he thinks it's going to be even more targeted. There'll be other languages, and it will not be only Spanish. So this is kind of an experiment for
them. They already have messages this time in the advance letter in Spanish, Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese, and Russian, directing people to, I guess, a website for language assistance. The foreclosure crisis in this country is going to play a role in tracking everybody down this time, Carol.
Yes, they're concerned about that. Nobody really knows exactly what it's going to be when they send out census takers or numerators, as they're called, to homes that have been foreclosed on.
And nobody's home. It's abandoned.
No one's home. They'll have to go back until they can determine that it's actually vacant and not just somebody away on vacation. And what they're really worried about is that, in terms of the ultimate impact, is that when somebody is filling out his census form ahead of household, fills it out for everyone in the house,
mm-hmm.
he may not include, say, his sister, brother-in-law, and their six kids who are living in the basement because they've lost their homes, until he can get on his feet again, because he sort of figures, well, they're
mm-hmm.
not really living here.
But
so
that's the way
they really
count.
Don't know what the impact will be.
But people should include them. And it's by where you're living at the moment of the census, as I understand.
At the moment where you normally reside.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily at the moment of the census, but where you normally reside.
Mm-hmm.
College students, for example, are expected to fill out their forms in their dormitories where they live, not at their parents' homes in another jurisdiction.
And the stakes here, $400 or $500 billion annually, what primarily in Medicare and then roads and school education spending. It depends
Medicaid
on
is, Medicaid is the biggest chunk
Medicaid, mm-hmm.
that relies on census figures. It's about 60%, give or take. The next biggest share is road construction and highway funds, and then after that it's education grants and housing. But it's a total of approximately 215 different programs that have been identified by in a study the Brookings Institution did of this. With the Brookings Institution says that probably with all the stimulus money that has been added in the last year or so, it's probably more than $500 billion that's at stake.
Not to mention, of course, seats in Congress. Carol Morella with The Washington Post, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
The Census Bureau is trying to get the word out in lots of ways. Here's a wrap about the census from a TV spot.
We need participation for better schools and hospitals. Assessments, the tool to make it all possible. Pursue it, there's nothing to it. Every woman and man, they can do it. We can't move forward until you mail it back.
With us now from Washington, Amy Sullivan, contributing writer at Time Magazine, regular contributor to the magazine's political blog, Swampland. Amy Sullivan, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
The Constitution says we've got to do it. Founding fathers understood, and it was kind of revolutionary at the time. You have to know who's in the country and in what numbers to know how to represent them in a democracy. But there has been some pretty strong political turmoil around the census this time.
Well, this has been something that's come up in the last few censuses, actually. Mm-hmm. It's been particularly pronounced this year, probably in the wake of some of the Tea Party movement that's been going on. But in general, yes, there's been a concern, particularly by Republicans, that we might be overcounting people in the census, and by Democrats that we may actually be undercounting people.
And some from the left about the amount of information that's collected and in the post-Patriot Act world, how it's going to be used, whatever the guarantee is given.
Well, yes, it's actually interesting this time around that you see people from both extremes of the political spectrum who are concerned about how the government might use the information that's collected in the census. Again, as Carol went through the questions, they're fairly anodyne, just getting a count of people who live in households and mm-hmm. their name, race, gender, that sort of thing. And yet you've got people on the right who are concerned about government use of private and personal information, including even members of Congress like Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota. And you have folks on the left who, in the wake of the Patriot Act and the post-9/11 use of personal data by some government agencies, who are concerned as well about the privacy of this information and what it could be used for.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the 2010 census, letters in the mail, forms going out next week, and what's coming in the changing face of America in the numbers. Census Bureau doing a lot to get people's attention here and get a high rate of return for an accurate count. They've got the Census Bureau on a NASCAR racing car. They got Marie Osmond out in Las Vegas and on the QVC shopping network, all kinds of black radio, Spanish language, soap operas, you name it. $133 million campaign launched in January. Here's Miss America 2010, Caressa Cameron. She's been signed up to help encourage census participation.
Like you and everyone living in America, I'm a part of the people, as in we the people. We all count in the 2010 census. 10 questions, 10 minutes. So fill out your form and mail it back. Thanks, people.
Sounds pretty chipper, pretty easy. Amy Sullivan is with us from Time Magazine. We're joined right now as well from Pasadena, California, by Joel Kotkin, leading expert on economic and social trends. He's presidential fellow in urban futures at Chapman University. His new book is The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. Joel Kotkin, welcome to On Point.
Nice to be here.
310 million people are expecting the census will show this time. And you're saying by 2050, and that is only 40 years now, we will top 400 million. A good thing or a nightmare?
Well, it really depends how we handle it. I mean, it certainly is an indication of the vitality of the United States. It obviously will make us a country with more young people than most of our competitors who will be aging much more rapidly. But obviously, if you have an expanding workforce and there isn't work, it could be very negative. So it really is a basically a positive thing, but how we handle it will determine whether it's more positive than negative.
Amy, you say that even this 2010 census, let alone what we see in 2050, may be a real wake-up call to some people who don't realize how much has changed in this country since the last census just 10 years ago.
Well, it's always hard to recognize societal change as it's happening. It's only in retrospect that we see how the country has changed as a whole. But if you look back at the last 10 years and the changes we've seen demographically in terms of the number of minorities, the question for this census that everybody's focusing on is that whether we're going to see actually a majority minority birth rate in this country. That is, that the majority of babies born are actually of minority races. And this may actually be, in retrospect, the biggest decade of change that we've seen since the 1960s, when immigration laws were liberalized and we saw a real influx of people from other areas of the globe to the U.S.
You're saying we may need to change our national kind of self-narrative, Amy.
Well, it does affect how we see ourselves. Certainly, we can have kind of pictures of what the U.S. looks like, but until the census actually fills in those numbers, and it's so much more important, even the more than the surveys that the government also does, the longer ones to kind of fill in the gaps, because it is a count of every person living in the U.S., and that provides a much more complete picture than we have, you know, in the middle of the decade of predictions of where we might end up.
I've seen news reports that we're already headed into a majority-minority in terms of births in this country. When Joel, are you seeing, in your look at the demographics here, the America goes minority date? When does that happen? Everybody's been led to expect it.
Well, of course, it's impossible to predict exactly when, and even if it will ever occur. I mean, I think we will certainly be moving into the 40s and 50s in terms of minority population. But the thing that I talk about a lot in my book is, by 2050, this may be kind of a moot point because there will be so much mixed race households in the United States. By some estimates, one out of every five kids will have at least one grandparent who is of a different race, that we may not really care very much. I mean, I think that this is part of the sort of evolution of America from the first census, where people were worried about whether there were too many Germans, till over the last 100 and 200 years, the country keeps changing. And so that what used to be a big issue, if a Polish person married an Irish person, like, who cares? And I think increasingly we won't care if an African-American marries an Asian or whatever. And in some places in this country, like in places like Los Angeles and some of the real melting pot metros, you're already seeing racial intermarriage at 10, 15, 20% of the total. So this is going to be much more complicated than the country becoming minority. It will become also incredibly diverse. And even within each ethnic group, there will be greater diversity.
Amy, that goes to your changing narrative. It was just white-black for so long. And now so many variations that that narrative begins to fall apart. Maybe the color narrative, Joel is saying.
It does, although at the same time, every time you have a large-scale change in a country, you see a reaction of people who need to hold on to that old narrative. And I suspect that some of that is what's going on with what you heard from some of the Sarah Palin supporters in 2008 and since, and among some of the Tea Party supporters who talk very much about what the real America is and who real Americans look like. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, what they're describing is an America of yesteryear that doesn't in many ways reflect the diversity that we have, certainly of races, but also, as Joel was talking about, the fact that we are becoming a country of mixed race, that is going to be perhaps somewhat pointless to talk in terms of, shuffling people into boxes in the future.
We've got responses in a couple of directions on that. If I could share them, here's from a listener on Facebook. Shane says, I think the new census will show that white America is losing its power of majority more and more. And he says, that's a good thing. Diversity is growing and it's here to stay. Then there's, of course, as you say, Amy, there's been Tea Party pushback, however it's put, to the census out there, over the government's reach and power. On the Asheville Tea Blog, we found this video from a man named Jerry Day.
Maybe the census would be a good place to start to let the government know that we know that they are not authorized to demand our cooperation in the contrived schemes they come up with for information gathering.
Contrived schemes. I mean, this is right in the U.S. Constitution, right? The Founding Fathers put it there.
It is, in fact, and it's very clear. This is not a count even of citizens of the U.S. It is a count of every person living in the U.S., and that's caused some political problems in the past as well. You need to count, for instance, illegal immigrants in the census because it's important for the distribution of resources to know not just how many citizens you have, but how many people in general are using the roads, are using other services in a locality.
Even though they're not entitled to vote.
They're not, but that's not the point in the Constitution. Women weren't allowed to vote when this was put in the Constitution, and yet it was still important to know how many people you had residing in the United States.
Let's turn to our listeners, John in Lansing, Michigan. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom and Amy and Joel. I was wondering, in prior census years, there was a short form, and about one of every 10 or one of every 100, I forget what the ratio was a very long form that had much more detailed questions about your history, your background, your family, your income. Is that not the case this year with this 10 questions, 10 minutes push?
Amy, Joel, I haven't seen any mention of that here. It's supposed to be the shortest form in the history of the census. Amy, do you know? Is there a longer one for the lucky 10th?
It's a very good question. In fact, in the past, about one in six households used to get the long form, and it was randomly selected different households in different years. This year, actually, every household in America, and that's about 134 million, are going to receive just the short form with the 10 questions. And what the government is going to do to try to fill in the gaps is something called the American Community Survey. Which will, again, be sent by random selection to households. And that'll be done every year to ask some of these more detailed questions to try to get at people's educational background, employment, and such.
So that goes on in a kind of different cycle. Let's go to Jason in Rock Hill, South Carolina. Jason, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Well, a couple of things. I heard, again, some comments about the Tea Party people. I know that's sort of a tangent point, but Tea Party people are not interested in hanging on to outdated ideas so much as they are interested in hanging on to the ideas that made America great. Mm-hmm. And as far as the census is concerned, I hear a lot of stuff about, oh, this is so great, you know, we're becoming more diverse and all this stuff. Is that really so great? I mean, is that really such a wonderful thing?
And are you saying, Jason, that you're not asking that in racial terms, but in cultural terms? In, I mean,
well,
the world is diverse, and the world comes to this country of immigrants. I'm just trying to get a beat on where you're coming from.
Well, I guess where I'm coming from, and it's not really covered in the news that much, but look at what happened in South Africa. I mean, it's a murder capital of the world.
Let us pick it up. Jason, thank you for your call. Joel, you hear unease with the change we're in the midst of. It is a big change. Jason gives voice to it right there.
Well, there's always been that unease, but I do want to just say that to some extent the Tea Party movement is, from what I can gather, is not a primarily a white supremacist movement or anything like that. I mean, they have people probably associated with, like any mass movement, you know, you're going to have variations. After all, you know, Sarah Palin's children are of mixed race as well. So, I don't think that that's at the real core. I think there is a concern of the rapid change, not so much ethnically as culturally. And I think that that's something that, again, you're going to always see. And we really have to understand that what happens over time is that the immigrants and the newcomers, they're not just sort of changing our country, but we're changing them, and they are becoming more and more Americans. I always like to say to my, like even to my students, I'll say, if you went back to 1965 and you pick somebody out and you've transported them to the United States today, they would be astounded by the ethnic mixing, by the prominent role played by, well, obviously African-Americans with the President of the United States, but before that, Secretaries of State, on television, in the movies, as presidents of corporations, and obviously the changes with women as well. So these would be very wrenching changes, but I think generally speaking, I think that they're fairly positive. But every time you get rapid change, you're going to get some sort of pushback, and really many different kinds of pushback, some from the left, some from the right. But the country is changing in a very exciting way, and I think we have the opportunity on a global level to be kind of the world's first multiracial superpower, because we really will not be linked to a particular racial background. And I think that that could be a great advantage in a world in which power is really going to be increasingly shared with the United States India and China as probably the three most important countries.
We'll talk about how you see that. I'm still hung up on Sarah Palin's mixed-race children. I missed them at the convention and everywhere else. I'm not aware of that.
No, well, her husband is part Eskimo.
Oh, okay. Things get very subtle in this country.
They do.
Amy, you hear Jason's response as well. He's saying, look, it's not the change in race. It's about values. But then, you know, the reference to South Africa, which certainly had had and has a powerful racial context. I mean, as you say, Amy, these are big changes. They're not necessarily easy to for people who are still thinking of an older image of America to accommodate.
It's not. And it does say something about our country. And I would suggest perhaps it says something good that we are focused on these questions and that we are aware of the fact that we're not all the same. And we're trying to get a read of the country and what it actually looks like. You know, the vast majority of countries in the world conduct a census. Mm-hmm. And yet there are very, very few who ask questions about racial identity. We're one of the few that does that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is something that we have, as a country, have always kind of focused on, sometimes for ill. But right now, that gives us a sense of really what the diverse mix is and a sense of who we're becoming as a country.
Here's a web comment from a respondent who says, the government has no right to know my age, sex, race, or who owns the home. What have the courts said about that? How far does that go? Is that a new line of questioning, Amy, or is it clear from the court record that the government has that right in their interpretation of the Constitution?
There certainly has been some questioning in the past from people about how far you can go, whether it is just the simple counting of people who live in the U.S. I'll admit that I'm not an expert on what the court's interpretation mm-hmm. of this has been, but it is worth pointing out again that the census form this time around is asking far fewer questions than it has in the past. So for people who are concerned about kind of the extent to which the government is seeking to learn information about them, this is actually one of the least intrusive censuses that we've ever seen. Again, just these 10 kind mm-hmm. of basic questions. And again, it's we heard at the beginning of the hour, there is no penalty for not filling out the census, except that it could affect the resources that come to your community.
And it will leave us understanding the profile of our nation less well. Paul in Omaha, Nebraska, you're on the air, Paul.
Hello. Earlier, Tom, you had mentioned something about the census might change our, the way we look at ourselves and the way we view ourselves as a nation. And,
mm-hmm.
As I told your screener, my reaction is that I would hope that the census would prompt a discussion as to, you know, who we really are, and you know, the whole issue of citizenship. The analogy that I used when I was talking to your screener was the fact that we talk about our nation as being a melting pot, but other people use the analogy of more of a stew, that you can see the individual components and they try to stay separate from each other.
How do you feel about that, Paul?
Well, I think we're missing a larger debate in this country about what citizenship really means, and to be, you know, to be here in this country and what the responsibilities are. It's all well and good to be of a certain ethnic background or a particular race or what have you, but if we are not all on the same page and we're not all pulling together in the same direction, you end up basically with the kind of environment that you have in Iraq, you know, where you have clans and you have individual interests that will not come together. And I'm afraid that, in our diversity that we're seeing in this country, we're losing the fact that what made this country strong in the first place was the fact that we all pulled together with a common ideal.
Paul, we'll come back and look at that after a break. Of course, we've done it before with many waves of immigration, but we'll look at it this time in a new century with the numbers getting very big and in new directions. Thanks for your call, Paul. We will look at that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Talking this hour about the 2010 census. Letters in the mail this week, forms going out next week, and looking at what's coming in the changing face of America. Amy Sullivan is with us. She's a former national editor, now contributing writer at Time Magazine. She contributes to the magazine's political blog, Swampland. Joel Kotkin is here from Pasadena, California, author of The Next 100 Million America in 2050, when he sees a 400 million-plus population in the country. And Joel says, in terms of our competitive position in the world, that's a good thing. Margaret in Ames, Iowa, you're on the air, Margaret.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, I think the advertising for the census is great. They're using a diverse group of people to encourage you to fill out your census. And I did last time. In fact, I did a long form last time, and I'm all for it. Love to see the results. But why, when we are in a budget crunch, are they sending out a letter this week saying that your form's coming next week? I mean, what a waste of money.
It can sure look like that. Margaret, let us pick it up. Amy, what the Census Department is saying, and I cited a little bit earlier, though, is that when they give people a heads up, they're more likely to anticipate and be ready and participate. And again, they said for every 1% increase in response, taxpayers save $85 million. But a lot of people have looked at that 120 million piece mailing and said, wow, that's expensive, Amy.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I actually received the same letter in the mail yesterday, and I admit that was one of my first thoughts. As a former social science student, I also thought back to the fact that there's been a large body of research showing that if you give people a heads up that a survey is on its way, you really increase the response rate dramatically. And as you said, it saves quite a bit of money because you don't actually have to send out a person to go walk to a house to follow up and ask this information. I would gather that the amount that is saved is going to more than offset the cost of the letter. It's also important to point out here because most of the grumbling about the letter has come from some conservative observers and some conservative blogs, that back in 2001, when we all received those tax rebate checks from President Bush's first round of tax cuts, mm-hmm. we received a letter ahead of that letting us know that the check was in the mail, which may well have been a heads up, but was also interpreted by some people as kind of a political pat on the back that
President Bush is giving you some money.
So there is precedent for doing
this. Aren't we great? Here's a Facebook comment from Karen. She says, I'm just baffled by some of the backlash to the census. It's in the Constitution, for goodness sake. I guess I don't understand the feeling of persecution that so many people have about anything to do with the government. And that does feel kind of newer and more keen this time in Tea Party days. Margaret, in Omaha, Nebraska, you're on the air, Margaret.
Well, hello there.
Hi.
I'm calling because I do the genealogy for my family, and the census and counting Americans goes all the way back to the 1700s. It's exciting to be able to see where your family has traveled from, where they're traveling to, and mm-hmm. the different reasons they move around the United States as they're here. My particular one side of the family followed the railroad, and that was absolutely fascinating. I think that we forget what a sense of pride being who we are, where we live, and why we're here is important to future generations. The census is not just our count for today, but it's our count in history.
It's a great point, Margaret. It helps us understand ourselves right now and look ahead. But centuries down the road, people look back, people like yourself and many others, and the census is a big deal in tracking what they'll understand. Iowa City, Iowa. Armando, you're on the air, Armando.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, very well. What do you know?
I think there was a gentleman called in a while back saying something about South Africa, how he was kind of worried about people not getting along or whatever happened.
Right, right.
That made me think. It's kind of sad. I think that this census is going to surprise a lot of people how many people are actually more Democratic than Republican. There's a lot more young people who are married and don't really talk and can't really make their voice heard because they're obviously trying to work and get by it day
mm-hmm.
by day.
Mm-hmm.
Especially like me, since I'm a Mexican American and mm-hmm. my wife is Caucasian American. She's from Iowa and I was born in Texas and we met 10 years ago. But I just wanted to say that to that gentleman that that's kind of sad. That's the reason people are unhappy right now. That they don't. That's the only thing that's not good about this country. People, they're going to realize that the more population, the more cultures, different cultures we have, the better it's going to get. They're going to realize that. It's going to get better.
Armando, we take your point, and you're looking forward. You're looking forward to seeing the accurate representation of who's here, who we are. Joel, that kind of goes to your theme.
Well, I think there are a couple of things, and I've been thinking about it ever since that same caller that Armando is referring to. First thing is that really we are seeing a remarkable change, as Armando suggested, in terms of people's attitudes. There was a question about what percentage of the population supported interracial dating, and it was about 45% people over 65.
That was on a poll somewhere, not on a census form, sure.
No. Mm-hmm. It was a poll, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think it was Pew. But they said about 45% over 65 thought interracial dating was okay. It was over 90% in the millennial generation, the younger generation today. So this is an enormous change, and I think this is something that obviously a lot of people miss. The other thing is this question is the country becomes more diverse and more ethnically mixed. I would argue that the importance of the core values of the United States actually become more important. They are what hold us together.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great problems you have today in Europe, I spent a great deal of time in Europe, is much of the European culture, and the same thing could be said in Japan, is based on a shared racial national experience. And very difficult to rewrite that narrative when you're bringing in people from very different cultures. In America, there really isn't just a single racial narrative. There's always been an attempt to construct one, and then the next tide comes in and knocks that wall down.
Right.
So I think that there is not an inconsistency at all from greater diversity to actually becoming more of what America is all about and what are our core values.
Amy, you've been thinking for a while about how the parties see this. Armando brought up party politics here. And there is kind of a general Republican, lean toward undercounting and maybe a Democratic lean toward overcounting or at least fully counting.
Well, it's important to separate kind of the concerns about the census into a few different categories. We've heard already today people concerned about what the government does with the information that they answer in the census. We've talked about the resources that get allocated based on how many people are living in a certain area. And certainly that is a political concern because Democrats in general are more likely to represent places where you have people who are hard to count, whether it's homeless populations, whether it's places where you have larger numbers of illegal immigrants who may not want to give answers to a government worker who's knocking on their door.
Maybe nervous about it, yeah.
And places with minority communities where there's also been kind of a longstanding suspicion of someone from the government who comes along and knocks on your door. But there's also a third concern here, which is the political implication in terms of redistricting and assigning congressional seats, adding congressional seats to a state or taking them away. And there's already been some predictions about kind of what the changes may be based on this next census. And they do kind of present a challenge, particularly for some Republican critics of the census, because, for instance, in a place like Texas, Texas gained congressional seats last time, and this time they're actually projected to gain 4 full congressional seats in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the fiercest critics of the census are coming from a state like Texas in the Republican Party.
Are you assuming that translates into a Republican gain if Texas gains 4 seats?
Well, last time around, that translated into a swing of 6 congressional seats to the GOP. And it's not sure that that's exactly how it'll play out this time because there was some funny business involved with the redistricting last time around, led by Tom DeLay.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, at least a few of those seats are likely to go to the Republican Party, particularly given the role of the legislature in some of the redistricting.
So in that case, it's odd to be resisting a process that may leave them with more seats, more power in Congress.
Absolutely. Well, that's the million-dollar question for everybody, is how it will actually fall out. And if it helps you, then you're probably in favor of it. And if you're not sure if it's going to help you, then you may be a little more hesitant.
And nationally, what are people expecting in terms of Republicans or Democrats? Who's going to gain from what we learn in this census, Amy?
It's a very good question. I mean, some of the states that are projected to lose seats are states in the Rust Belt. There are a few Northeast states. Obviously, in a place like in New York or Massachusetts, if you're losing congressional seats, you're probably talking about a loss of a Democratic representative. And the states that are looking like they're going to gain some representation are mostly gathered in the Sun Belt and in the West.
Joel, you're looking out to 2050 and say, well, that's where a lot of the action is going to continue to be. In any case, we sort of thought that maybe resource issues might constrain the South and Southwest, but you're not seeing that. You're seeing that area as boom land as we add another 100 million or so.
Well, I think that the population growth in the Sun Belt will slow for compared to where it was in the past, but I think it's almost inevitable that it will continue. There are lots of ways that you can, for instance, deal with the water issue. One big thing, of course, people forget about is the vast majority of the water goes to agriculture. And certainly, if you just change the crops, you could probably have more water. There's lots of things you can do with conservation. But I think people will continue to go to places that are warm as opposed to places that are cold, you know, all things being equal. But I think also you're going to see a big movement of a population to more rural areas, people looking to slow down the ability of the internet to allow people to work in remote places. We're already seeing growth in places that you would never expect it, Fargo, North Dakota, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, cities like and regions like Omaha and Des Moines becoming more populated. So I think, you know, when you have 100 million more people, there's lots of opportunities for lots of growth. I mean, even if the vast majority of the population lives in suburbs or smaller towns, but still 20% may want to live in cities. That's 20 million more urbanites. I think that's going to keep developers busy.
And you celebrate all that growth as an advantage for the United States. You've touched on why, but give us your rationale. How does that become, in your view, such an important sort of power cell for the country?
Well, first of all, I believe that young people, and I wrote this book really for my students and for my two daughters, I think young people are the source of inspiration, change, innovation in a society. And our society, which will be aging, like all societies, will be aging less rapidly. So that, let's say, by 2050, maybe we have 20 to 25% of the population over the age of 60. Many of our competitors, Germany, Japan, Korea, will be at something close to 40%. I think if you have too many elderly people and not enough young people, I think that creates fiscal problems. I think it creates a problem with innovation and change that could be very dangerous. So although we have many challenges with the younger population, mm-hmm. particularly in terms of creating jobs and wealth, I do think that there is the opportunity that we have as a younger country to compete more successfully on a global level.
Let's go to Bemis Point, New York, and Tammy. Tammy, you're on the air. Hey, Tammy, are you there? Oh, let's go to Rochester, New York, then. Catherine, do we have you?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, you're on.
Hi. One of the things that I listen to this conversation and talk about diversity and democracy, and I'm always astounded that people fail to bring up not democracy, but capitalism, and how we also, as a country, fail to see that the diversity we claim to embrace, when we go to other countries and see how westernized they're becoming, and this is not because of the embrace of democracy, this is because the embrace of the financial system of capitalism. People around the world look up to it, not for our core democratic values, but the fact that we have all the money, or that we, you know, have a rule the financial system of the world.
Catherine, you're fuzzing out on me, but I think we've got the point. Joel Kotkin, what do you say to that?
Well, of course, right now, I'm not so sure the rest of the world is looking at our financial system as any great exemplar of anything,
yeah.
Except excessive greed and stupidity. But But I do think that the rest of the world does look at the United States as a role model. And I think part of it is obviously technology and capitalism. But I think over time, our greatest advertisement, if you will, is the fact that for all our diversity and all our conflicts, this is an amazingly diverse country that actually seems to work, that we don't have, as one of the callers talked about, Iraq, you know, where every single ethnic group has its own political party and its own faction, and that they would talk about separation. I think that's just not happening. So the success of this multiracial democracy and its ability to coexist in a mostly capitalist framework, I think, is a great role model. And let's face it, there are at least two countries that have somewhat similar situations. One is Australia and the other one is Canada.
Amy, you said early on that you feel some people kind of yearning back to the 1950s. It's hard to keep up with the changes. But when these numbers come out, it's going to be right there, right in front of us. Maybe this puts to rest some of the old view of the country. Do you see more conflict or maybe just more clarity coming from this census?
Well, to be honest, I think we'll see some of both. I think that it will be helpful and probably clarifying to have a more accurate picture of what the country looks like. But again, as we've heard throughout the hour, that can be somewhat frightening for some people. It can be challenging to their notions of what the country looks like. And so I think we'll be seeing both an embrace of what the country looks like, but also a little bit of concern about where we're headed.
Well, whatever it is what we are in this great big democracy. And with that, we will roll on. Amy Sullivan at Time Magazine, it's always great to have you. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
It was my pleasure.
Joel Kotkin joining us today from Pasadena, California, author of The Next 100 Million, America in 2050. Joel, great to have you. Thanks for joining us today.
Been my pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.